Hello, students, and welcome to Class of X, the free internet course on how to read and enjoy the X-Men comics better. I'm your teacher and host, John Reisinger, and today we're talking about some more X-Men 97 cartoon episodes and comic tie-ins. We're going to go over episodes 3 and 4 today from Disney Plus's new series and talk about how the comics can help explain what's happening in the show. So, once again, welcome back to class. We're doing what everyone loves to do in school, which is turning on the TV and zoning out for a bit. I know when I was a kid and a teacher did that, it didn't matter what the movie was, didn't matter what the video was, that was a good day. And today's a very good day because we're going to talk more about X-Men 97, which has released 4 episodes up at this point, and I'm enjoying them all for all various reasons, and they're all making references to stuff I love. They're showcasing characters that I'm so happy to see, and it's bringing me so much delight and joy that I didn't know I needed so badly right now. But I wanted to continue this trend of talking through the episodes, and not for like any sort of like spoilers reason, but more for like a, hey, You liking the cartoon? Cartoon's good. You know what's really good? The books. And even if you don't want to read the books after listening to this episode, which I can totally understand, we all have busy lives and plenty of things to do, and who has time to read these picture books? But what I can do is I can give you a little podcast episode, just a little audio upload into your brain to go like, hey, I watched the show, and now, because of this dude in Texas who's been reading comics since he was 7, I also know what was going on in the comics or what they made reference to in the show. So we're going to go over episodes 3 and 4 today, like I said. And episode 3 was called Fire Made Flesh. And I got one of the best messages ever from Mikey Randolph, who was previously a guest on this show, I believe during the Inferno episode. And he told me that I helped prepare him for this show so well. And I told him that was the best compliment ever. Because Fire Made Flesh was a less than 30-minute summary of the entire Inferno saga that occurred in the X-Men comics in the 1980s. If you want to read the Inferno saga, there are tons of tie-in issues, and it's a huge crossover event, but I'll reiterate that if you just want to read kind of just the core X-Men stories, all you got to do is read Uncanny X-Men 239 to 243, X-Factor 36 through 39, that kind of follows Jean Grey and Cyclops' kind of participation in the story, and then New Mutants 71 to 73 really doesn't play in very much into what they adapted into the cartoon episode, but it still is a fun run of issues that covers a little bit of Magic's story, who we talked about recently. And so if you do want to read them, you can check those out. There's a trade paperback that collects all of those at the very least. Like I said, there's a lot of other tie-ins because this is a full Marvel crossover event. There's like Daredevil and Marvel and Spider-Man crossover issues for Inferno. Inferno, as a reminder, or as a new info for those of you who just don't want to listen to past episodes of this silly show, it was a culmination to a big plan to unveil that Madeline Pryor, a character that had shown up after Jean Grey had sacrificed herself to defeat Dark Phoenix, a.k.a. she unalived herself. Madeline Pryor, who looked exactly like her and sounded exactly like her, turned out to be a clone of Jean, which is why they immediately jump into that plot point in the cartoon. And while X-Men 97 made a lot of connections to the original source material, there was a lot of differences that were kind of fun to compare and contrast. One of which was a big mystery at the end of the episode that I like that for the reasons that they're doing it in the show, that they left the thesis point, the beginning point, the swap of Jean and Maddie a mystery. In the comics, we know exactly when it happened because it wasn't a swap. Madeline was never shown as a replacement or like a duplicate of Jean. She was her own person. She was a pilot in Alaska. Scott met her while he was kind of trying to do a little bit of an eat, pray, love time to find himself again. Cyclops wanted to find his groove back after losing his lover. He met Maddie, and Maddie was her own individual. And Maddie married Scott. Maddie had a baby with Scott. It's Maddie's baby is Nathan. There is no mystery as to whether or not Nathan is, you know, Gene or Maddie's baby. Although, while the cartoon kept it a mystery, if you look it up and you want a little bit of some extra fun, the internet kind of figured out that the best point where it probably happened was at the end of season 4 of the original 1990s X-Men show, because Jean isn't really seen for the most of season 5 or a lot in season 5. And I think someone even pointed out that when she's seen, she doesn't have her ponytail anymore. But you have to check me on that info. I can't remember. I didn't write that note down. That was a huge difference, but I liked that for this like very quick synopsis of Inferno, visual synopsis of Inferno, that it made you wonder what was going on and what was the what's the truth. Because I think in storytelling sometimes, and X-Men does this a lot, it doesn't necessarily matter if you know what the actual answer is. It's the journey along the way and the development of the characters that's the real meat of, you know, the entertainment value of all of this. I've stood by the idea that while it was, to me, fun and satisfying to find out Wolverine's real origins when they finally revealed that in the comic book Wolverine Origins, Mystique, on the other hand, is a character that we don't know how old she is. We don't know how she was born. Was she born presenting as a mutant? Is there a non-blue version of Mystique that she looks like? Is even the blue version of Mystique her actual, the way that she looks? It's mostly, we just don't know all the answers to her origin. And I, for one, would like to keep it that way because I like it, because it makes her mysterious, hence the name. And she's it brings gravity to the character, and I enjoy that. Another big difference between the cartoon and the original Inferno's comic that written by Claremont is that while the X-Men members go through a bit of a mental hellish fight on the campus of Xavier School, it's a real fight with the hellish forces of the Dimension Limbo in original Inferno. And they're actually fighting real demons and not having some sort of psychic battle or anything like that. There's no illusions. It's pretty fun if you want to go back and read the Inferno comics, because New York City basically gets a little bit of a Ghostbusters makeover, and like mailboxes come alive and eat people, and subway cars turn into giant demonic worms, and buildings turn into demons and all that kind of stuff. It's very, very fun, very spooky and good times. But in the cartoon, to make that a little bit probably simpler and budgetarily doable, they kept it to that kind of mental battle where they fight their demons, sometimes like cartoonish demons, and sometimes they fought their own internal demons. There's actually a reference during one of their struggles where Gambit was having his little mental battle, and he sees Rogue and Magneto getting touchy-feely and hoochie-coochie with each other. And for those of you with a sharp eye, I might recognize that Rogue and Magneto are actually wearing their, I would call, iconic costumes from their time in the Savage Lands. The Savage Lands is the mysterious part of Antarctica, or of the Arctic. Wait, is it up top or is it down below? I think it's in Antarctica. Sometimes I forget which way is up and which way is down. Forgive me for that. But it's this land that's like a land before land before. What is it? It's like the place where King Kong goes underneath the ground, where it's like, oh, it's all green and dinosaurs are everywhere and that kind of thing. That's what Savage Lands is, except it's in the Arctic or Antarctica. You'd think I'd keep these things straight at this point. They got stranded there for a bit, and that's when they got amorous with each other. And so I love that they showcased those costumes because they're very, very fun. They're both very risque for the characters. There's a lot of, if you read those issues in the comics, there's a lot of panels of both Rogue and Magneto not wearing very much, and that's fun. Another big change that they made for the cartoon was that in the end of the episode, it is revealed that Sinister, having stolen the bebe, very much like Labyrinthian David Bowie, they kind of play it off that Sinister infects him with this techno-organic virus in order to make him a stronger mutant, which I think they were insinuating he was doing that in order to make him strong enough to defeat his master. In the comics, which is Apocalypse. Not quite sure, just making theories at this point. I don't remember if they actually made a reference to Apocalypse in the cartoon episode. If they did, I didn't write that down. But that's not actually how it goes down in the comics. Nathan does not get infected with the TO virus, as we have shortened it down to in the comics biz. He doesn't infect him. Sinister doesn't infect him at all with it, and definitely doesn't do it during Inferno. It doesn't happen until a little bit later that Apocalypse actually steals the baby, and he kind of puts in this failsafe to infect the baby with this virus. And it is actually, and in the end of the episode of the cartoon, Bishop does what happens in the comics and says, I can take him to the future where he can be healed. I only have a one-way ticket, though, so you got to say goodbye to your son. That's almost completely comics accurate, except it's not Bishop that does it. It's this mysterious character called Ascani-san, which is part of the Ascani clan. That's this kind of cult in the future, led by the descendants of Jean Grey and Scott Summers. And they, I don't know if you'd say they worship, but they believe in this Messiah character, which will be Nathan, who is also known as Cable. And so Apocalypse infects him, and Ascani takes him to the future, and that same kind of thing, one-way trip, going to have to take your kid. And he goes there to be taken care of and to learn how to keep the virus at bay. A fun little fact that while I was looking up to check my notes on Cable and his adventures with his techno-organic virus is that the techno-organic virus is part of a group of viruses called the transmode viruses, and they originate from this alien race called the Technarchy, and they're kind of like, they're like the Borg. I've talked about them before. They just assimilate things into their race of, you know, technology-based beings. The virus that's in Cable is actually a variant that was, quote-unquote, created by Apocalypse. But the variant that Apocalypse has is based off of the variant that he is infected with. Apocalypse is kind of an amalgamation of mutant powers and a techno-organic virus and celestial technology, who are these godlike creatures. I think the Celestials made an appearance in the Eternals movie. A bunch of other advanced technology. But where Apocalypse got that techno-organic virus was way, way, way in the past. Apocalypse has been around since like the Egyptian pharaoh times, when he went by the name Ensaba-Nur. And he was leading kind of a Alexander the Great siege around Egypt and Africa. But he kept getting thwarted by this mysterious combatant that he would call the Traveler. Spoiler, the Traveler was Cable. Cable was, in his younger years, traveling back in the past to different spots to learn as much as possible about his ultimate foe, Apocalypse, so that he could go back to his present time and defeat Apocalypse while he is a despot in charge of the entire planet, I think, at that point. But in a fight with Apocalypse and Cable, Apocalypse manages to actually cut off Cable's like metallic arm. He thinks it's armor, but it's actually his cybernetic arm. And like this pool of cybernetic techno-organic blood kind of pools on the floor, and Cable is able to escape, but Apocalypse gets mixed with that pool when he gets injured later on and is like being healed in the celestial ship that he has at the time. And so, technically speaking, if I'm getting my facts correct. The techno-organic virus that gives Cable his like cybernetic cyborg look is actually a time paradox where he is infected by a variant of it that originated from him going back in time and giving it to Apocalypse. So that's hopefully not going to make your brain explode, but it's a fun little fact about Cable, and I love that big old man with huge guns. Madeline Pryor, let's talk about her. They made a few changes to her in the cartoon. She doesn't in the cartoon, I want to say they actually made a little bit of an improvement. A lot of times in comics, for whatever reason, editorial reasons, authorial reasons, you know, reasons because they think the audience needs this or wants it. Oftentimes, let's say female characters are not given the same opportunities, endings, stories as their male counterparts. A good example being that when Chris Claremont made Madeline Pryor, he's gone on the record saying he had no intention of her turning into this crazy woman who wanted to, you know, who made a deal with the devil and ends up trying to kill her own baby and plunging New York into a demonic hell. But it was an editorial shove, urge, push that he leaned into and turned into a very, I think Inferno's a great story, but it's a very sad story. And sad stories are good, but it was also fun to see someone take an adaptation of the story and give Maddie a little bit of a, it's not a happier ending, but a more satisfying. It was a happier ending because she doesn't go crazy in the end. She finds her way back. She helps Scott, you know, free her baby. She realizes that she needs to go figure her stuff out, and she leaves of her own regard and like gives herself her name, very much like a queer kid, which I loved that. Renaming yourself is a mutant thing, but that's always been something that as the queer community is connected with, because we often are born with names or orientations or genders that are assigned to us that we don't associate with. And a lot of people change their names for many reasons. And so I love that Maddie made her name. But in the comics, it's very different. She's Madeline Pryor because Sinister named her Madeline Pryor when she like got her a little bit of a backstory before she went out into the real world because she broke out of her test tube that she was growing in. And her other name, Goblin Queen, that was a little bit of a funnier kind of way of introducing that in the cartoon. She's like, I am the Goblin Queen. She's the Goblin Queen in the comics because she actually has like a goblin army. They're demons, but they're like little goblins. They look like little goblins. And so she's the Goblin Queen. And so that's why she's always seen like in that very, very sensual, but so fashionable costume. But she's surrounded very much like Maleficent in Sleeping Beauty by these little minions and goblins. Again, very David Bowie-esque. So it makes a little bit more sense. The Maddie name and the Goblin Queen name make a little more sense in the comics. I thought it was a little silly in the cartoon, but didn't take me fully out of the show. But I really wanted to point that out. And then basically, other than that, they had to truncate the story a lot because, you know, this took place over the course of, gosh, 6-7 months of comic releases. And so this is a, you know, 20-30 minute episode. And so there's a lot of other, you know, things from the original Inferno that aren't included. And that happens with adaptations. But generally speaking, I was so satisfied and so happy to see that Inferno, a great story. Everyone always focuses on like the Phoenix Saga, you know, and Magneto and all kinds of stuff. And I'm like, can we tell stories with like, you know, Madeline Pryor and Emma Frost and Mystique and all that a little bit more? Because I love the ladies of the X-Men, and the lady villains of the X-Men are awesome. They're like all big drama drag queens, and I love them. And I'm so glad that this one finally became, you know, something that people can watch on their TV and watch on their streaming services. And whether or not they actually know it's based off of a comic book, because I, watching the original 90s X-Men, you know, and watching through them all, like, I didn't know all the comics that these were all references to. I was still young, and I was still trying to get through some of the comics, and I didn't have as much access to them as I do now in this digital age. And so I hope that these cartoons, I hope these episodes kind of, you know, maybe inspire some people to be like, okay, X-Men's cool. I want to go read them. Some other fun, like Easter egg references that happened in the episode. I mentioned the Savage Land costumes, but we do get a glimpse of Bishop's sister, Shard. Bishop has a sister. I don't know if a lot of people know that. And she's a mutant that's in the future. And she kind of works with him to try to, they're like part of a rebellion in the future. Their future is the Sentinels are in charge future, which is different from Nathan's future, which is supposed to be Apocalypse is in charge. So they're kind of actually merging those two timelines now that I'm talking about it out loud, because those are two different alternate Earths. And so Cable is not going to a future where Apocalypse is in charge, but he is supposed to be the Messiah that saves everyone from Apocalypse. So it'll be interesting to see how they turn that around. Another fun thing to always mention is that they're using Morph to really give us some comics candy by having him turn into some characters that might not have time to show in other ways. But we can see people like he turns into Magic with the sword when they're with her soul sword when they're fighting the Goblin Queen in that cathedral, and then when he gets taken over by the Goblin Queen, he turns into the demonic version of Magic, which is called Dark Child, and so that's both versions of Magic, which is a great callback to the original comic. Like I said, the New Mutants tie-ins for Inferno are all there's a lot of it is a Magic story, because Magic has tie-ins to Limbo. She's the queen of Limbo at certain points in comic history, and so it's fun to see her. And then almost like as a foreshadowing to the next episode, we get to see Spiral when he wants to raise hands to win a vote with Spiral's many arms, who we do see in the next episode. And before I talk about the next episode, they tacked on these little part one and part twos of the Forge and Storm stories. And I'm going to hold off on covering those until they've kind of put a period at the end of those and see how, because I really want to comment on like how the whole thing turns out. And I've got plenty to talk about with Inferno and then the next episode. But I do have to give at least one assignment to y'all. I highly recommend you find, either the issue or the digital issue, or even just Google the panel of Forge's first appearance. One of my favorite first appearances, based solely on the fashion he's wearing when he appears in the doorway to who I believe is a Mystique mysterious, like she looks like her government cover that she's using at the time, and then a assistant of Mystique. But he appears in this doorway in Uncanny X-Men 184, and he's wearing this like striped polo t-shirt, and he's very short inseam shorts, and he's got a cane. It's very dapper. It honestly is a look that people would totally be wearing nowadays, because everything comes back. I realized also as I was looking that up to check my notes that issue came out in August of 1984, which means that Forge is only 1 month older in real life than me. I'm a September 1984 baby. And so I'm Forge's age. Just kind of, I like that little connection to the X-Men comics. But let's talk about episode 4, which was hilariously called Motendo. And I knew that something was coming that was going to be a reference to the Konami X-Men game, because I saw some of the previews of the episode. But I wasn't prepared for what it was going to be about and how they were going to tie that into the actual show. I love that they utilized Mojo as a vehicle to introduce a gazillion references to the Konami arcade game that every kid has at least knows of, if not loves. That's a 90s kid. This was the Konami X-Men arcade game was one of the most popular arcade games at the time and of all time. And I will not hear anything otherwise about it. But this episode is great, because not only does it give a moment for Jubilee and Sunspot, who's just going by Roberto, give them some spotlight time and develop them a little bit and kind of continue to, urge Sunspot to find his way into this X-Men world. But it's also some fun time to see Mojo, who's always such a silly and fun character. I really like Mojo. He's such an odd creation by, I believe, Was he created by Claremont? I think he's a Claremont creation. Yeah, he's a Claremont creation. But then on top of that, it's also like, it's the X-Men arcade game, but it's also it's an homage, whether it realizes it or not, it has to realize it, to the pilot episode of the original X-Men cartoon. I'm going to get into all of that, but let's kind of go through some of the stuff that happened in this episode and where they were pulling that from the source material. Namely, the reveal about halfway through of this mysterious character that was helping Jubilee and Roberto through the video game that they got sucked into, which is also a very 90s reference. Oh man, I can't remember the title of the movie at this point, but that was a whole movie where like parents got sucked into the TV and video games. It's also like the new Jumanji movie. There is a glitch character, very Wreck-It Ralph style, that helps them along the way. And I don't think they name her in the cartoon. She's just clearly an older Jubilee. But she actually is from the comics, and she's this character called Abscissa. And she is a slave to Mojo that really doesn't get any more time in the comics more than two issues, where Mojo steals Jubilee and then tells her takes her to like basically the end of time and says, if you don't sign away your life to me, I'm going to mess with the end of time and time itself. And Jubilee figures out how to like thwart him. And by doing so, instead of Abscissa being this like beta test character that's stuck in the system, but now knows it front and back, when Jubilee like fixes the timeline, Abscissa just disappears and is gone forever. It's kind of sad. So it's kind of fun to see this Abscissa get to help Jubilee and kind of continue to live her best life in this system. Fun little fact, that character was voiced by Allison Court, who is the original voice of Jubilee. So new Jubilee got to talk to original Jubilee in the episode, which is delightful to say the least. Mojo as a character, I think we've talked about him a few times on this show, although I don't think we've covered any specific storylines. I have talked about how I want to do a X-Men Babies or an X-Babies episode, which is one of Mojo's creations. Mojo is this character who is in charge of this alternate universe that he named after himself, the Mojoverse. And he is an alien, part of this alien race called the Spineless Ones. Hence why he's in that kind of assisted device, that like little spider, like, you know, a kind of mobility machine, because he doesn't have a spine and has to use that to walk around. He is actually like, he was created as a parody of network executives at the time in the 1980s, and which is extra funny that they would put him into the X-Men 97 right now, considering all the kind of attention that's being put on network executives, which are no longer like, there's network executives, but it's like streaming executives at this point. You know, studio executives are the ones who are the ones that they're a parody of. I wonder how much that episode had to go through revisions so they didn't make any sort of like references that pissed off any people. But what they did make reference to that could not upset anybody was the Konami game. I don't think a lot of people realize this when they're playing the Konami game, but it's actually based off of the original pilot of the X-Men cartoon called The Pride of the X-Men. Pride of the X-Men actually came out in 1989, and it was part of this block of Marvel cartoons that were going on at the time, including like Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends and Fantastic Four. But it was at the end of that. It was actually, Marvel was going through financial troubles at the time, and they got this pilot episode out, and it kind of had mixed reviews. The animation was really good. The animation was originally done by this company named Acom. The story was a little campy and not as dark as the, like, and serious as the comics were, and so people weren't sure if they liked it. In 1992, Margaret Loesch, who was like the head of Fox Children's Network, she's the one who had like you know, basically had wanted this pilot to be made in the 80s, and so as she was the head of Fox, contracted Saban Entertainment. We know Saban from a lot of things, including Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. Funny enough, Marvel Entertainment in 1989 canceled all of its Marvel cartoons, except for one cartoon, Muppet Babies. Marvel made Muppet Babies, which is so fun. But yeah, Saban was contracted to produce the show, but they didn't animate it. They had a Korean studio called Acom. Sorry, Acom is the one who made the one that we all know from the 90s. Toei Animation made the original pilot, and they kind of used extra budget. Not extra budget. They actually used a full episode budget for the RoboCop animated show to make the pilot episode. And so if you watch the, you can find a copy of Pride of the X-Men on YouTube, basically, and you can watch it. And it's really fun animation. And then you watch and you go, oh, I'm seeing everything from the arcade in here. And I totally get it. And that's also why in the arcade, Dazzler is in the arcade, because she was in the Pride of the X-Men pilot. But then they kind of changed things around. It was originally supposed to be Kitty Pryde was supposed to be this like damsel in distress, viewpoint perspective of the viewer character. But then in the 90s one, Jubilee became that. Jubilee became a brand new character they created to be that kind of youthful, young, new fish out of water character. But that also makes it so fun how Mojo said Dazzler wasn't available in the cartoon episode that we just watched from Motendo, which again is like layers upon layers of a reference to the Konami game. The Konami game is wonderful in so many ways. One of which is my favorite is that it has some rough translation of Korean to English for the characters that say words. So you get some funny lines in the arcade game that are pretty iconic, very much like all your base belong to us kinds of things. But yeah, so that's why then to bring it back to the Konami game in this Motendo episode, that's you're seeing just so many levels from the Konami game, including like the Savage Lands level and the Sentinels fight and all that kind of stuff. There was also a fun little reference to another Mojo character in the episode before Jubilee and Roberto get sucked into the game. There's a little plush toy next to the Motendo, which is a great little jab at Nintendo. And it's Longshot. Longshot is one of Mojo's greatest creations, who's this kind of mutant creation, and he's kind of like the savior character in the Mojo verse, and the Peter Pan to the Hook of Mojo. But if you blink, you might miss him. I was also looking up some stuff about like X-Men, Pride of the X-Men, Konami stuff, and I happened upon a rumor, which is 100% a rumor. There's no way this will ever happen. But if it happened, oh man, I would love this. People have rumored that for the Deadpool 3 movie, Deadpool Wolverine movie, there might be like a cameo of Dazzler. And Dazzler is this pop star from the comics. She is the most iconic pop star ever, you know, in the comics at the time. And there's a lot of characters in Marvel Comics that are big fans of her. Juggernaut is a huge Dazzler fan, which is great. But everyone thinks that the best cameo for Dazzler, the best person to play Dazzler, would be Taylor Swift. And I could not agree more. Taylor Swift was meant to play Dazzler. And I don't think Taylor really wants to do any more movie work. I know she kind of dabbled in a little bit back in the day. She's doing quite well just focusing on her music. But if she found some time between tours and could show up for, you know, a day or two on set and just be Dazzler for a moment, I would giggle with delight. And I know a lot of people would like to see Taylor Swift in a Marvel movie. That'd be great. The final thing about the episode that I wanted to point out that was so delightful to see was, like I said, Spiral shows up in this. And while in Motendo, she is a joke in that Mojo says, you know, like fix the tech problems. And she's like, you killed all of your tech support. And so she's the tech support now. She's not really tech support in Mojo world. She's kind of his right hand woman who is also his kind of like bodyguard and you know, big gun. And I could do a whole episode on Spiral, and there's still a lot of Spiral comics that I need to read. But she is this enigmatic, bizarre creation. You know, you see her and she's got multiple sets of arms. She's got this interesting samurai like helmet. She's got fur boots. She holds swords. She has a million powers. She's magical and has mutant powers. Spiral is so fun. I hope she's not just going to show up in just this one episode. It might be fun if she could show up elsewhere as an actual combatant. I'd love to see her in action. But I had to just point out that Spiral made an appearance. The show is going so well. I'm having so much fun with it. I can't wait to see what they do with the Forge and Storm story, which actually so far, to give you a little preview into talking about that, is actually following the comics pretty closely. All the way to Forge being the one who developed the technology that the government took and used to depower Storm, all the way to this mysterious appearance of this demonic creature at the end, or this otherworldly creature at the end of their part two, which is called the Adversary. And so we'll see how that kind of resolves. But until then, I really do encourage you to go read some of these comics. Inferno is a great read. If you want to read some Mojo, go check out some X-Babies issues and maybe you'll get a leg up on the episode that I will eventually do about those. But until then, be good, be kind, be brave, read more comics, and thank you for listening. Bye.